Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of July. The military coup in Turkey last Friday that failed. Who was responsible? Who is this mild-mannered Muslim cleric living in Pennsylvania who some have said was pulling the strings of the attempt? He has denied that. Today's news is nearly 35,000 members of the military, police, and judiciary have been arrested or dismissed. 21,000 private school teachers have had their licenses revoked. What are President Erdogan's plans now? Where does the country go now? How does it remain stable when it has many terrorist attacks by the Islamic State and Kurdish militants and many terrorist cells within Turkey? We, this hour, will be exploring all of that. Our guest is Dr. Henri Barki. He is director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, also a former public policy scholar at the Wilson Center. His works include Turkey's Syria predicament, Iraq, its neighbors, and the United States. He served as a member of the State Department policy planning staff working on issues related to the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and he did that from 1998 to 2000. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We always do. Here's how you reach the show, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Dr. Barki, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You have said that what happened is actually a terrible thing for Turkey, a coup attempt where you have no winners. Everybody loses. How does everybody lose?
Well, I mean, certainly when you have a violent attempt, unconstitutional attempt at taking power, I mean, you have done an enormous amount of damage to the institutions of the state. I mean, first of all, that the military, it was divided in this particular case. Yes, the coup failed, and that's a good thing, but the coup will have repercussions in terms of Turkey's future administration. We're seeing it already now. You're seeing purges. You're seeing people who are being jailed, people who are being kicked out of the bureaucracy. I think this will unleash an attempt by the government to consolidate power at the expense of civil society and democracy. Turkey's last coup was 1997. Between 1960 and 1997, it had 4 successful and 2 unsuccessful coups. And it takes a very long time, once you have a coup, for the body politic to essentially kick out the, shall we say, the bad virus or the germs that coup essentially creates. In other words, society takes time, governments take time, institutions take time to cleanse, to re-educate themselves about democracy or re-educate themselves with democracy. And we are seeing that now. I mean, we are seeing, we saw soldiers that did unspeakable things. We saw a government that now is clearly persecuting people. And for example, 1,577 deans of universities have been asked to resign.
Yes.
And I cannot for the life of me figure out why deans of universities, look, I was a department chair until last year. Why would you get them to, I mean, most of them will be reappointed, but clearly they're trying to cleanse people on the basis of ideas, and that's not good.
Mm-hmm. Well, does it indicate that there was a lot more support for this coup when you look at the number of people who have been purged than was initially thought?
Well, the fact that those people who have been purged does not necessarily mean that they were actually supporters of the coup. I mean, so the government is actually had lists of people it wanted to get rid of. So it is what it's doing now is actually using the crisis to facilitate its decision making process, facilitate its action, speed it up for sure. So those people were going to be one way or the other removed. It's where you see the expansion is when teachers' permission to teach is revoked. I mean, their licenses are revoked. I don't think that was necessarily in the cards before the attempted coup. But nonetheless, I'm not so sure that enormous amount of support for the coup. There were a lot of people on the sidelines who probably, without opening, cheered the coup on. But I also argue that people probably thought that pox on both of your houses. Mm-hmm. They may not have liked Erdogan, but they also probably didn't want the coup to succeed, because a successful coup is sometimes unpredictable, especially when it comes from more junior officers, which is here, because they don't necessarily have the same, shall we say, institutional knowledge, etc. I mean, a lot of them were generals, admittedly, but nonetheless, I would argue that a successful coup would have been terrible, because they would have been imposing an authoritarian system by fiat. So you cannot want the coup to succeed. And I think even some people who really disliked Erdogan don't want the coup to succeed.
Mm-hmm. The former ambassador to Turkey, James Jeffrey, was quoted in today's interesting front page New York Times story on this mild-mannered described Muslim cleric living in self-imposed exile in rural Pennsylvania, who some have said, I believe the president of Turkey, Erdogan, said this was pulling the strings of a coup attempt last week. Jeffrey said those followers have sought to gain power within Turkey by infiltrating state institutions, most successfully the judiciary and the police. They're a state within the state. They have infiltrated many places. Can you tell us more about this cleric, why his name is so prominent, and would you agree that they have infiltrated many places?
I very, very, very strongly disagree.
Really?
With Jim Jeffries, whom I know very well, over the interpretation of one word, infiltration. Mm. They did not infiltrate the state. They were invited in by Erdogan himself. Mm. And that's and people are talking, I mean, I think it's really doing disservice to what's happening in terms of analysis. You may have a position on the coup or not, that's another issue. You may have a position on Mr. Gulen, or which is positive or negative. That I don't care. But factually speaking, Mr. Erdogan invited the Gulen followers, and the two of them were in an alliance until 2013, when they broke that alliance in a very public, in a very, shall we say, almost violent way, right? So until 2013, Mr. Gulen's followers populated the Turkish bureaucracy because Erdogan needed the cadres that Gulen could offer, right, to service the state, because he himself didn't have the cadres. And when I say cadres, we should be very careful again what we say. Who is a Gulenist? How do you know whether somebody is a Gulenist? I don't. I mean, unless they say, I'm a Gulenist, mm-hmm. unless they actually work for an organization that I know is a Gulenist organization. I mean, they don't carry little cards with them or have a special tattoo of some sort that identifies them. So, but we know there are followers of Gulen, and there are many of them. But all of these people came into the state system, especially, as Jeffrey says, into the judiciary and the police, right, where they were very, very influential, right? And actually, we can speak later. I mean, when you talk to Kurds, Turkey's Kurdish minority actually probably dislikes the Gulenists more than they dislike Erdogan, or equally, I should say, these days. But because the Gulenists were ferociously anti-Kurdish and instigated all kinds of sham trials against the Kurds. But the Gulenists, as an organization, are an interesting organization. I mean, we have to not lose sight of the fact that it is both a religious organization, many business organizations. They ran newspapers. They created peak business associations. They opened up schools all over the world, always propagating a Turkish ideology, a moderate Islamic Turkish ideology, always pushing Turkey. I mean, they're very, very nationalist. Erdogan and Gulen broke over the question of corruption. Their relationship had started to fray in the early 2010s over Mr. Erdogan's approach towards the Kurds. Mr. Erdogan was looking for ways to end the civil war and try to figure out ways to resolve the problem, I mean, to his credit. And Gulen was very much opposed to that and tried to sabotage it. That didn't work. But what then happened was in December of 2013, on two different days, sets of conversations were leaked to the press, conversations that incriminated not just the then Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, and his family and his son, but all kinds of places over big graft allegations, that they were taking money, they were enriching themselves, they were cutting corners, and so on and so forth. So that's when the break happened. And the genius of Erdogan was, when he was being accused in public, and you could hear his voice on these tapes, of real malfeasance, he basically decided to do the best defense is offense, and he went on a massive onslaught against Gulen and tried to, and started then to weed out Gulen supporters from the state and try to undermine Gulen everywhere. But fundamentally, until then, they did not infiltrate the state. They were invited in. The only place where you can talk about infiltration is the military. But then, the military has always been fairly autonomous, and the military has very anti-religious, call it standards, has worries about religious, because it's the most secular institution in the country. And when I say secular, I don't mean secular in our sense, anti-religious institution. So they have always been very, very careful not to allow anybody of any religious persuasion into their ranks. So they weed out people constantly. Mm-hmm. So we have a situation which I find kind of very difficult to understand and fathom. They charged today 99 officers, senior officers, generals, and about one stars and two stars, and some even higher, and admirals. Over the weekend, they had arrested 103. So approximately one third of the Turkish high ranking officer corps. I cannot believe that all these guys are Gulenists. Some of them may be people who tried to take advantage of a coup situation because they were going to be cashiered out of the military and way of extending the. Some of them may have been arch Kemalists, you know, the followers of the founder of Turkey who are and don't like Erdogan and hitched a ride with the Gulenists, if it is Gulen who organized this coup. But I cannot really believe that there was as many as 103 or 99 Gulenists in the... Mm-hmm. There may have been 99 coup plotters. That's different.
Let's pause for a moment, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our guest this hour, as we look at the failed coup attempt in Turkey last Friday, our guest to explain all of this is Dr. Henri Barki, director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. As he was describing what's happening with the military, Turkey, of course, also has Syrian refugees to deal with and terrorist cells within its country. Does it not put the country in a dangerous position to have such upheaval, particularly among the ranks of the military at this point in history? Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we like to read your messages, so feel free to call with your comments about what's going on in Turkey as we carry on here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Turkey this hour, and Dr. Henri Barki is our guest. With Turkey having to deal with so many issues, with terrorist attacks in the country, with refugees to deal with the Kurdish situation, isn't this a particularly dangerous time for the country to have such upheaval in government and in the military? Dr. Barki?
Well, I mean, look, this is never a good time for this kind of upheaval. This was very serious. Lots of people died, and the coup plotters were amazingly brutal in some respects because they launched bombs where there were civilians, and they also attacked the parliament. So, yes, I mean, it is a terrible time, but there's never a good time for a coup. I mean, anything that is extra-constitutional, especially when you have the military do it, it is particularly upsetting, and we will see the impact of this coup for a very, very long time.
How so?
I mean, this is Well, for me, we are seeing now the immediate reaction, which means the purges. And we're going, next will be increasing consolidation of Mr. Erdogan's hold on power in terms of institutional changes, constitutional changes. And most people kind of are predicting this linear, shall we say, trajectory towards a really an authoritarian one-party state. What I would say is that the jury is still out. That is to say that whenever you have a coup, you also have counter-reactions. Even when you have a failed coup, you have counter-reactions to the measures that will be taken. And we should not think of political life in Turkey in linear form. I don't know what's going to happen, but let me give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
Of what can happen. One is that now the military, which everybody had assumed until now had been defeated in Turkey politically, because Turkey's military had always been one that interfered in politics constantly. People thought, myself included, that in 2007, when they tried to intervene in politics, Erdogan very smartly called elections, and the only real topic on the agenda was whether or not something that the military wanted to happen should happen, and people resoundingly said no. And we all assumed that the military was out of the game. Well, now they're back in the game. But most of the officer corps did not participate. But now that officer corps is amazingly sensitized to what's going on. Erdogan himself will not trust any soldier from now on. And if I was him, I wouldn't. Why should I? Right? So now you have a different dynamic between Erdogan and the military. And the current military will watch very carefully how their brethren, even if they were on the wrong, even if they were, how they are taken care of, I mean, how they are charged. If they are humiliated, tortured, you're going to have a reaction. So I don't know how that is going to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the Turkish economy has done exceedingly well over the years. Right. Even today, for example, it has 4.5% growth rate, which I think every European country would love to have, given how poorly Europe is doing. But already Turkey was suffering, as you said, from terrorism. So tourism was down. Now, after these events, you can expect that no tourists will be going to Turkey for a long time to come. You don't bring the tourism industry back to life overnight. I mean, a year from now, people will still remember the coup. People will still remember the terrorist incidents, if there are no more terrorist incidents. But also, the uncertainty has already forced Standard & Poor's, the rating agency, to downgrade Turkish bonds. The Turkish lira has lost a lot of lost value today. Sometimes this is good because you can export more, but it will harm the Turkish economy. There's no question. So what happens that 2 or 3 years down the road, if the Turkish economy is really stagnating because of all these events? Erdogan will not be able to say, look, the economy is not growing because there was a coup attempt. Even if he did, nobody would buy it.
Mm.
Or I shouldn't say nobody, but there will be a significant segment not buying it. One of the things that Erdogan is doing is targeting universities. Right? So you may end up having a brain drain. Turkey expanded its university system very, very rapidly. Quality is already not great in many of these institutions. And if you have a brain drain, what are the consequences of that? What are the
sure.
consequences of people not wanting to do business with Turkey as a result? So there are all these things that are at the moment unquantifiable, but may, and I'm not saying it will necessarily happen, but we need to think that this is not a linear process, that this is, it will have ups and downs, and all of these, we're dealing with human beings and social animals, so it's very difficult to predict.
We welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We'll move on in just a moment to how we are responding to the coup. What do we think of Erdogan? And what do we think of Turkey? How important is Turkey to us? And what kind of relationship do we have with them so that they will carry on handling the fallout of the civil war in Syria? We'll continue with all of that discussion after we start taking some calls. And we start with Jimmy in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Yeah, I guess my comment is I think this coup is a very bad idea. It's going to give Erdogan all kinds of excuses to crack down when he really probably wouldn't have the support within Turkey before this coup attempt. And I just think until countries, and a lot of them are in the Middle East nowadays, and until they can settle their differences through a political process, even though it's slow and frustrating and ugly sometimes, I just think that they're never going to have a stable economy where their people can have a chance to actually prosper. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Henri?
Well, no, look, the great problem in the Middle East is, first of all, you have very few democracies, and Turkey is one of them. And so whenever this happens in one of the few democracies in the Middle East, it's a very bad example. I mean, in that sense, your caller is touching a very important point. And for the United States, for example, Turkey has always been used as a model country, a country that, with all its imperfections, with all its past coup attempts, a country that should be an example because it's dynamic economically. It's an ally of the United States. It has had a democracy. So this hurts the Turkey's image absolutely, and actually, maybe for the Middle East, it reduces or at least questions one of the few good examples.
What has been the response of the United States to Erdogan's crackdown?
Well, I mean, the White House and the State Department have basically said, look, they support Erdogan, but they hinted that he should be moderate in his response in terms of the crackdown. The big issue for the United States is the Turks want Mr. Gulen, who is in self-imposed exile. By the way, Gulen came to Turkey, to the United States, before Erdogan came to power, when the Turkish military was much more influential and he felt he was being persecuted by the military. So he actually came to the United States before Erdogan came. So now Erdogan is calling for his extradition. And so, there are two problems here. One is, if you are going to extradite somebody, you need to start a court process. You need to deliver sufficient, credible information, accusations that are provable in a United States court of law. There is no shortcut. And the Turks are very impatient, I mean, in this particular sense. I mean, when you look at what has come out in terms of the rhetoric in Turkey, whether from government sources or pundits or journalists, etc., they basically say, well, you went after Bin Laden. What proof did you have? I mean, Bin Laden himself said, I did it, but that's another issue. But so they expect that we will turn around on a dime and give Mr. Gulen. And he's a legal resident. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, I mean, it's going to be very hard for the Turks to prove anything. And B, even if they had some credible information, I mean, let's say that they do, you also will have very good lawyers in the United States who are going to defend Mr. Gulen and try to blow holes through Turkey's accusations. And given that everything else that's going on in Turkey, they will make the claim that, look, this guy is going to be tortured or persecuted, so we should not send him back. Whatever happens, this is going to take such a long time. I can see at least a few years, if not longer, for this to be adjudicated in our system. And therefore, the Turks are going to get very, very frustrated. And this is a question of managing expectations. I mean, now people are angry. They want this to happen very quickly. But Erdogan and his team need to understand that this is not an easy process, and they should kind of temper expectations, because otherwise it may create problems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, the broader question of Turkish-American relations is something maybe we'll discuss later, but what I should say is we should expect the unexpected. And in the sense that if we don't, you know, if people get frustrated because Gulen has not been extradited, you may have demonstrations against the United States, you may have, you know, things can happen.
Right. And what about Gulen? Is he talking to people in Turkey right now? Does he express in a lot of spoken statements concern and a different path forward after the failed coup attempt? Is he active at all in keeping alive his movement?
Well, he's always been on the quiet side. I mean, he's given a few interviews and to the American press and maybe to the European press. I haven't seen that. It's not like the Turkish press today will publish anything by him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you look at the Turkish press, Erdogan controls directly or indirectly probably 80% of the Turkish press. And a few newspapers that were kind of bucking the trend, what I saw before coming for this interview is that a lot of them are not publishing at the moment. Some of them were known to be sympathetic to Gulen. Gulen had other newspapers in the earlier days. They've been taken over by the government.
Yes,
this happened before the coup. I mean, like 6-9 months ago, some of them. So those newspapers don't exist. New newspapers emerge to replace that gap, but those are not publishing because they feel the heat and they can't. The press, you know, the news presses won't publish it, even though the journalists may write stuff. So what's really left is social media and the internet, and even there, you're going to see the crackdown is increasing, and it's going to become more difficult for these people to be able to. I expect, for example, a lot of people's Twitter accounts will probably be. They're going to figure out ways to maybe block them.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be the crackdown is going to intensify as we go along.
What's TV like in Turkey?
I'm sorry, what?
Is television state controlled?
No. Yeah, you have. In fact, this is one of the biggest. I mean, mistakes that the military made that night, and so they. In the old days, when you did a coup, you would go to the one television or radio station, and you would take it over and read a statement over that, and that was it. Right? 1960 was like that. So you know, all these coups were like that. Today, there's a proliferation of media. They went. They used the shall we say, the coup book of those days, and they went to the state television station and forced a television presenter to read the statement. Well, there were all these other television stations that were broadcasting different information, and one of them managed to broadcast something from Erdogan, right? So there's a multiplicity of voices today. I mean, most of them are afraid of criticizing Erdogan, but nonetheless, I mean, the coup plotters made this cardinal mistake of just going to one television station. I mean, they made large number of mistakes. I mean, in a way, I mean, I kind of got this piece for one of called the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I mean, it's true. I mean, these guys were for military officers, for even if they had 2 stars and 3 stars. I mean, they were amazingly incompetent.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls. We're talking about the failed coup in Turkey. 800-486-8655 is the number. When you look at the number of licenses of teachers, Henri, 21,000 private school teachers, 35,000 members of the military, police, judiciary, arrested or dismissed. Doesn't this create real chaos in the country right now? I mean, you got to go to school, right? You got to have a military protecting you and a judiciary and the police. Is it a total state of upheaval in Turkey right now?
Well, look, I would argue that, I mean, look, it's a country of almost 80 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about 26,000 teachers, yes, that will probably create an upheaval for a group of students, but not the totality. And similarly, both in terms of the bureaucracy, you're talking about the very large bureaucracy, this will cause problems. There will be problems with the military when you lose almost 100 officers, senior officers. They have to be replaced. These are very tricky and complicated positions sometimes that you don't, when you change so many of them so quickly without preparation, without doing a proper transition, there will be chaos. But that doesn't mean that Turkey will be undefended. I mean, we should be careful in terms of, there will be a certain amount of chaos, but it is a controlled chaos. It's not going to be like people will be roaming the streets because there's no security forces or the students will not go to schools for a long time. I mean, people will figure out, solutions will be found, and it won't be terrible. I mean, we should not exaggerate that. But, in the past, the other thing is that in past coups, there were purges. I mean, and for example, in the 1980 coup, 30,000 people had been dismissed from their political jobs. People were deprived of citizenship. A number of associations were closed. So it's not. So Turkey has lived that. Now, this is in some ways more extensive, and also in the 1980 coup, so you had generals who controlled everything from top to bottom, so there was less chaos and so on and so forth. But still, I mean, purges do happen after coups, and this is actually happening after a counter coup, which is a little bit more interesting, maybe academically for people like me. But if the purges were to extend much deeper, then we have a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the places I worry about are universities, and so 1,577 deans were asked to resign, mm-hmm. or were forced to resign yesterday or this morning. Most of them, I suspect, will be hired back. But what I don't understand is, why are you firing deans when you're dealing with a counter coup? It's not as if these academics were involved in the coup.
Right, yeah.
Right? So this is kind of gratuitous punishment or an attempt to find ways of cleansing the universities of people who disagree with you. There are a lot of academics who signed the petition, 1,200 approximately, who signed a petition some months ago saying, it was a harsh criticism of the government, an unusually harsh criticism of the government conduct in the Kurdish regions of Turkey, the way the military has been conducting itself. So the government has initiated, this is before the coup, initiated judicial action against all these all these professors. Some of them have been fired, and people now expect that in this new atmosphere they will fire them. But, okay, so you signed a petition. You don't like the content of the petition, but you don't fire a professor for that. Maybe you can reprimand them, cut their pay if you want, if it's a state institution. But there will be damage done to the university. I mean, universities are not, it's not like you're producing widgets and you fire the workers and in 3 days you can retrain workers, yes. New workers too. It's a very different, complex institution. And if you start replacing them with less professors of lesser qualities, then you really do have a problem. Mm. And I'm not saying that all academics are good. I mean, there are many academics whose stuff I would not necessarily read, or they would not read me. But I mean, who are on that list? But the point I'm trying to make is, you don't in universities, education establishments are institutions that have very, very deep roots, and if you start yanking those roots, the rest of the institution will die, and in ways in which they're not be perceivable in the immediate future. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes, and then when you want to rebuild it, it takes time.
Let's go back to phone calls. Glenn is next in Reedsburg. Hi, Glenn.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
It's my understanding that since Erdogan's rule things in Turkey have been becoming more and more conservative, Israel type of religion and rules associated with that, including one that comes to mind is that he was really discouraging women from laughing in public, and that some of the people there are not possibly accepting that. And I was wondering how this might be affecting, or how this might relate to, if your guests could tell us how this might relate to this current coup, or if this might be connected in some way.
All right, Glenn, thanks.
He was making references to what country?
To Israel.
Anyway, this, no, I disagree. I mean, I think, first of all, this has nothing to do with Israel. It's two different religions. It's a different system. I mean, not both democracies, but different issues. No, it has not. It's not. Yes, Turkey is becoming more conservative, and Turkey is becoming more. The criticism against Erdogan is becoming more authoritarian. Conservative, yes, but countries become more conservative and then more liberal with time. But you can also see exactly the same things going on in Europe as well. I mean, you see, for example, an uptick by the right wing in many countries in Europe. So it's not an unusual thing to see. The question is whether or not the rule of law and democratic principles are followed, and that's why you see some erosion.
Is Erdogan a religious guy?
Yes, a very religious guy. No, I mean, this is a guy who takes his religion seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we've had presidents in the United States that took their religion very seriously, or sometimes pretended they did, but Erdogan generally takes his religion seriously.
And is there dissension? Because give us a little brief history, if you would, please, of Turkey. It used to be more secular when it came to government, didn't it?
Okay, so Turkey essentially was founded by Kemal Atatürk, who fought a war of resistance against a series of allies, the British, the French, the Italians, the Greeks, who had invaded Turkey after World War I. And he was a military officer, and he essentially created what modern Turkey was, essentially a very secular state. But secular, and it's very important to understand Turkish secularism in comparison with secularism as we understand it here. His view of secularism was essentially the elimination of religion from public life altogether, mm-hmm. but the banning of religion.
Mm.
All right, so you couldn't. I mean, you couldn't be a pious person, in a sense, and really be a government official. Right? And in fact, pious people, and you will see that those who are near Erdogan and those who came up with him in the movement, I mean, for them, they went through a very difficult time as when they were growing up and they were socializing, because the state persecuted anybody who made any connection between religion and politics and religion and education and religions. So what Atatürk and his followers tried to do is literally eradicate religion forcibly. So it was not a democratic system. Even when democracy came to Turkey, the military always made sure that the secular principles would be adhered to. For instance, let me give you an example.
Sure.
In 2000, the notion, yeah, let me put it this way, the notion that a religious woman who covered her hair could work for the government was anathema.
Hmm.
So you had a choice. You either uncovered yourself or you didn't get a job in the government. You can get a job in the private sector, but when I say the government, meant universities, meant, you know, anything that the government owned touched.
A lot of places.
So you were excluded, right? And mm-hmm. for a country like Turkey, for which for a long time the government was one of the largest sectors, that didn't give you many options, right? So even the crisis between the military and Erdogan in 2007 that people assume, like myself, that the military had been defeated, was an event in which the secular president who had been elected before Erdogan became prime minister. Remember, Turkey, and this is also important, Turkey is actually a parliamentary system. Power resides with the prime minister. And Erdogan was first elected in 2002 as prime minister, as he became prime minister. And the president is usually, he is a powerful person. Oh, I say he because it's always been a he. Mm-hmm. But real executive power rests with the prime minister. So in 2007, Erdogan is prime minister, and the president's term ends, and he was, as I said, a secular, very bureaucratic person, and he leaves, and Erdogan decides with his chief collaborator, who was then the foreign minister, Abdullah Gül, that Abdullah Gül should become the president. And again, remember, the presidency is not as powerful. I mean, it has certain powers, but it's not as powerful as the prime minister. But the military essentially gave them an ultimatum, saying, you cannot make Gül president. And the only reason they did not want that to happen is because Gül's wife covered her hair.
Oh.
The idea that somebody who covered her hair would be sleeping in Atatürk's bed, which is essentially where the presidential palace was then, and where Kemal Atatürk used to reside, was anathema. Hmm. And it's over that issue in 2007 that elections were called, and Erdogan and his party and Gül won overwhelmingly. And we all assumed, essentially, that the military had been defeated as a result, because the people had voted and said, no, we prefer these guys than you.
Hmm.
So people, if you were genuinely religious, you face discrimination. The pendulum now switch is slightly going the other way, and in the sense that for Erdogan, what is more important is that you be of faith and that you be religious, and religion is permeating a great deal. I mean, there's now much religious education in schools, which didn't exist. There's constant references to religion, and that has become very much a referential point. That doesn't mean that the people who are of secular persuasion, who don't care about religion, who cannot live their normal life. I mean, I just got back from Istanbul last night. I mean, and you know, you go to restaurants, and some restaurants don't offer alcohol, others do. I mean, not everybody's covered. People can wear whatever they want, and so it isn't that. But clearly, there is a underlying tension, if you want, between the two parts of society. Except that tension always existed.
I see.
Except that who was on top was different.
Hmm. We take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the failed coup attempt in Turkey. Our guest is Dr. Henri Barkey, Director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. More calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to calls. Richard in New Richmond. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, this is a very, very interesting conversation that I pay attention to it because I'm a little familiar with some things that have happened in Turkey over the years because I had a sister that served in the Peace Corps way, way back when the Peace Corps was popular.
Hmm.
And she knows a lot about Turkey. And another thing is that I've heard conversations on programs about this Gulen, cleric, who supposedly is self-exiled, and I don't know how long he's been in the country, but he, your guest, did mention schools that he has started all over the world. Well, the conversations that I heard on these radio programs are that he's got schools in the United States, as many as 21 states, and he refers to them as charter schools, and he never uses his name in the building of the schools, that it's called charter science charter school or a school of business charter school, like the name of the town that it's in or the city that it's in or whatever, but never using his name. And which is, you know, there are a lot of charter schools, but what I've heard was, and I'd like to have the guest comment on this, whether this is fact or fiction, is that they're funded a lot by our own government who funds this. And they speak of science, you know, for instance, and they speak of business, and they speak of languages and all this sort of thing. But their main goal is to teach Islamic or Muslim, the Muslim way, the way of the Muslim religion, mm-hmm. So to speak, religion or their way of government or whatever you refer to it as, which is being funded by the government, which goes totally against, I think, our Constitution and the fact that we are not to fund any. I mean, they boot Christians and the Bibles out of schools, but yet they're funding the teaching of Islam in these so-called charter schools.
Well,
I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
We're funding religious schools as well now with private school choice, certainly. Is this true, Dr. Barkey?
No, they're not. I mean, they've set up a lot of schools in this country, but they're not, as far as I know, teaching Islam. They cannot impose any kind of religious ideology in the U.S. school, and they would not have been funded by public money. The public money, I think, comes because I think the law. I mean, anybody can build a if you have the bona fides, etc. You can build a school, and if you fit the requirements of the law, you will get a subsidy from the government. The Gulen schools have gotten into trouble in the United States, not for the issues that your caller mentioned, but rather for some shady business dealings. And in fact, there was an extensive 60 Minutes report on this issue, and they did certain things that were not exactly kosher, so to say, or they were not exactly by the book. And so some of them are being, my understanding is that they're being looked at from the judicial system is looking at them, but I don't know more than that. But you cannot in this country do what your caller suggested. Most of these schools, by the way, are essentially designed to help businesses affiliated with the Gulen organizations to also get contracts. In the third world, they are used to make connections with the elites in the third world so that businesses associated with Mr. Gulen, who help fund the Gulen movement, can get access to contracts. But that's legitimate. It's not, you and I can do the same thing. I mean, if you and I were to open a school in Tanzania that was the first rate school, and you, as a result, you get to know the kids of the elite that sends that school. You get to have the kids of the elites because they tend to send their schools to the best school. Send their kids to the best schools. Then you get to know the elite, and then you can make business dealings. I mean, so it's not, it's not anything illegal, but that's actually a very interesting way of expanding their business model.
Well, this came from the New York Times when they described the schools, and tell me if you disagree with this. His movement, Gulen's movement, centered on a worldwide network of secular schools, the goal to create a golden generation of young people who are educated in science but have Muslim ethics.
I don't know what Muslim ethics is. I mean, is Muslim...
I don't either, really.
Different than Christian ethics, than Jewish ethics? I mean, ethics is ethics. So, but what they do, I mean, what the New York Times characterization is fails to, they in most of these schools, they teach Turkish, right? And in most of these schools, they kind of... what they really are doing is propagating Turkey. I mean, the Gulen movement is a very... nationalist, Turkish nationalist movement. So for them, it has always been about teaching Turkish, but teaching the world about Turkey, so to say. So this is why the government also liked it. The Turkish government liked these schools, I mean, because those schools were essentially helping Turkey and Turkish businesses expand and so on and so forth. So... all these things that people now say about the schools are exactly the same things that people loved about the schools earlier.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We have to take it a little bit with a grain of salt.
Oh, we have so much more to talk about, and we're out of time. Dr. Barkey, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Wealth of information. Dr. Henri Barkey, Director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty for doing on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. We go hour two of our program to Dogs, Dog Medicine, the name of the book, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself. Julie Barton will be joining us. A reminder, we're in the week of the Republican National Convention, and you can hear that tonight at 7 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.